This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, January 14th, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, France's aerial bombardment expands in Mali as aid groups warn of civilian casualties and displacement due to the conflict. Family and friends of Aaron Swartz criticize federal authorities and MIT after news of the internet activist's death this weekend. Hundreds rally in New Jersey and New York to call for more aid to communities recovering from Superstorm Sandy. And we'll go to the UK, where funding cuts threaten daycare centers for seniors.
Had we not come here, we would be at home, and it would be very boring at home. So it's much better to come here and mix with people.
Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Nell Abram with FSR and Headlines. Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel today directed his staff to review the city's pension funds for investments in companies that manufacture or sell assault weapons and to sell off any such holdings. In a statement, Emanuel said the city cannot, quote, support or invest in companies that profit from the proliferation of assault weapons and the violence these guns bring to our communities. Further, the mayor said he will encourage mayors across the country to follow suit. In India, officials are investigating more brutal gang rapes and murders as protesters and politicians continue to call for stricter laws and increased public education about violence against women. Shreya Niazi has details.
Five men accused of the gang rape and murder of a Delhi medical student last month appeared at the district court in New Delhi today amid heavy security. The five accused face charges of abduction, gang rape and murder. The medical student died in a Singapore hospital 2 weeks after rape. The court delayed a decision on fast-tracking the case. Despite public outrage and calls for tough rape laws and better police protection, sexual assaults continue. In Punjab state, a 29-year-old woman was raped by seven men, again on a bus. The victim was kidnapped by the bus driver and conductor, taken to an isolated place and gang-raped. Police have arrested five people so far. And in another horrific case in Bihar, a 45-year-old woman was gang-raped, killed, and then her body was hung by her sari from a tree. The attack took place after she got off a train in Bhagalpur district. Shurenya Z, FSRN.
In Russia, tens of thousands took to the streets in major protests this weekend, this time against a new law that bans adoptions by Americans. Opponents call the measure anti-child, and hundreds of thousands have signed petitions calling for the ban to be lifted and the lower house of parliament to be dissolved. Ekaterina Danilova reports.
More than 20,000 people march in Moscow, and about 1,000 came to the rally in St. Petersburg on Sunday. Mikhail Makarov is a member of the Solidarity Movement for Democratic Reform. He said fewer and fewer people in Russia are able to adopt orphans, especially those with health problems.
Our salaries are much lower, so if an expensive treatment is necessary, most of our families couldn't afford this.
Natalia Marchikova attended the protest in St. Petersburg. She said Russia's passage of the law was an inappropriate reaction to the U.S. government's ban on visas for Russian officials tied to human rights abuses.
A symmetrical response could be to ban the entry of American officials who violated the human rights of Russian citizens, for example. But no way a game with children. That's not right.
Child welfare advocates will continue to collect signatures on the petitions until the 1st of February. Ekaterina Danilova, FSRN, Russia.
In Georgia, hundreds of political prisoners were freed from jail yesterday under a highly controversial amnesty law. FSRN's MJ Duvalier reports from Tbilisi.
Nearly 200 people were released from prison yesterday, just one day after a contentious amnesty measure was signed into law. In late December, the bill was vetoed by President Mikhail Saakashvili, but Parliament overrode his action. The prisoners had been convicted of high treason, military mutinies, or spying for Russia. But according to the new Georgian Parliament, they were political prisoners. Another 3,000 inmates are expected to be released in coming weeks. They represent about 15% of the country's entire prison population. Almost 14,000 more will see their sentences significantly reduced. Georgia's human rights ombudsman Uka Nanueshvili called the release as historic, but President Saakashvili warned of grave consequences of what he says is a mass release of criminals. Georgia has had, until now, one of the world's highest incarceration rates. MJ Del Valle, FSRN, Tbilisi, Georgia.
The Nigerian military says it has arrested a leader of Boko Haram, the Islamic militant group, blamed for the killings of hundreds of civilians. FSRN's Samuel Okocha reports.
According to a military statement, Nigerian troops captured Mohammed Sangina shortly after midnight on Sunday in the city of Maiduguri. The military says Sangina is a member of the movement's governing body and has coordinated most of the suicide attacks and bombings in several northern cities, including the Nigerian capital Abuja. Boko Haram is fighting to impose a Sharia law state across Nigeria. The group has claimed responsibility for various attacks against churches and other establishments since 2009. Last year, more than 600 people were killed in attacks blamed on the group. Samuel Okocha, FSRN, Lagos.
For FSRN from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. On Monday, federal prosecutors filed to dismiss charges against open internet activist Aaron Swartz, who hung himself on Friday in New York. Swartz was 26 years old. Federal authorities had charged him with illegal access to millions of academic articles through services at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and he was facing decades in prison. MIT's president sent an email to the school on Sunday saying he has launched an analysis of the school's role in the incident. The death of Swartz has also sparked calls for action on the issues of free access to information that he championed. In Washington, FSRN's Alice Olstein reports.
Computer programmers, open information activists, and the wider online community are mourning the death of Aaron Swartz, whose body was found in his Brooklyn apartment on Friday. Swartz, who created RSS technology and co-founded the web forum Reddit, was a prolific writer and speaker on politics, coding, his own mental health, and other issues. In an interview for the documentary series Steal This Film in 2007, he spoke about preserving the internet as a force for empowerment and equality.
On the internet, everybody can have a channel. Everyone can get a blog or a MySpace page. Everyone has a way of expressing themselves. And so what you see now is not a question of who gets access to the airwaves. It's a question of who gets control over the ways you find people.
An online statement from Swartz's parents and girlfriend blamed his death on those pursuing a legal case against him, calling his suicide, quote, the product of a criminal justice system rife with intimidation and prosecutorial overreach. In the summer of 2011, the Massachusetts U.S. Attorney's Office accused Swartz of breaking into a restricted computer at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and downloading millions of academic articles from the database JSTOR. They originally charged him with wire fraud, computer fraud, unlawfully obtaining information from a protected computer, and recklessly damaging a protected computer. But last September, they announced a superseding indictment that increased the number of charges to 13, which could have landed Swartz in prison for 50 years or more. U.S. Attorney Carmen Ortiz put out a statement about the case in 2011, saying, quote, stealing is stealing, whether you use a computer command or a crowbar, and whether you take documents, data, or dollars. The trial was set to begin this April. News of Swartz's suicide has already inspired a range of actions, from attacks on the websites of the Justice Department and MIT, to calls for the repeal of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act under which he was charged, to pledges to carry on his open data campaigns. Josh Levy with the organization Free Press, who worked with Swartz on several issues, called it a big moment for internet activism.
The fight that he was engaging in, which was making information that he thought led to a better democracy, that led to a more informed public, making that information free and open and accessible, I think, if anything, this moment has galvanized people to try to make that happen even more.
The tragedy has also inspired action in the world of academia. Friends and admirers of Swartz put out a call on Reddit over the weekend for professors around the world to share protected articles with the public. One of many to answer the call is American University anthropology professor Adrian Pine.
I mean, I basically put out there something that I'm already doing and that, you know, technically is illegal. That when I have friends or colleagues who really want to access articles, I mean, it's a fundamental belief of mine that information should be publicly available and free. And so I give them my password so that they can access that. Because I don't think it's only the hyper-privileged among us in society, like myself, you know, a professor, upper middle class, white woman, who should have access to this kind of quote-unquote expert knowledge.
Activists also plan to honor Schwartz on the upcoming one-year anniversary of the internet blackout protest against the anti-piracy bills in Congress called SOPA and PIPA. Schwartz was a key voice in a successful battle against the legislation, which would have cracked down on any use of copyrighted material. Levy and others are currently planning on and offline actions for January 18th. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
Hundreds of residents rallied in New York and New Jersey this weekend, where communities were hit hard by Superstorm Sandy. They're hoping to pressure Congress to pass tens of billions of dollars in aid for storm survivors. FSRN's Jessel Knorr reports.
On Saturday, hundreds of Rockaway residents and their supporters marched down a one-mile stretch of the storm-ravaged coastline. The crowd passed street after street of flood-damaged homes, piles of garbage, and pieces of a destroyed boardwalk on the storm-eroded beach. The theme of the action was Walk a Mile in Our Shoes, and community leaders and elected officials urged the public to hold Congress accountable for quickly passing an aid package. Congressmember Gregory Meeks represents New York's 5th District, which includes hard-hit Far Rockaway.
Come walk with me. Come walk these beaches. Come see these homes. Because if you see them, and come look at the eyes of all of you. Because when we look into your eyes, you will see great Americans who deserve the help of their government, and we need to pass the $51 billion now.
Many are frustrated by the slow pace of recovery and the delayed action by Congress. Rockaway resident Dennis Celebi has been volunteering since the storm hit more than 2 months ago. He says they still need basic supplies.
And I bring truckloads of water to people, drinking water, because water mains are breaking. And people aren't supposed to do their wash in the water, so certainly, of course, not drink it. And this is America, but it's not the America that I grew up in, and I still put the American flag on everything I do. So it's very painful for me to have to do this. And it's disgusting for me to see the things that I see.
Earlier this month, the House authorized nearly $10 billion for the National Flood Insurance Program, but did not pass an additional $51 billion previously approved by the Senate. This week, the House will consider two separate relief bills, the first providing about $17 billion in aid, the second an amendment from New York and New Jersey lawmakers for another $33 billion. The latter is expected to face opposition because it contains funding for non-emergency programs, including money for previous disasters, beach replenishment, and better storm forecasting. At the rally, residents like Prince Brown said funding preventative measures is essential to better prepare low-lying areas for future storms.
You have to take care of our first line of protection, and that's obviously, you see here, there's no rock jetties, there's no dunes, there's no boardwalk, there's no seawall, we have zero protection, it's gone. We used to have a bigger beach, the beach used to be up to here, now it's gone. It's been gone after Irene. It's gone after this Superstorm Sandy. We need a lot of money here put on the Rockaways by the Army Corps of Engineers, and we're going to be doing this until we get it done. So here we are. And we're doing this rally today to make sure it all gets done.
Residents also said passing the full aid bill was necessary to fix other potentially hidden problems.
The big analogy I'm trying to say is that what the Rockaways and all these communities are suffering from right now is a kidney punch. You know, everybody can see a bloody nose and you get the cameras on that, but where the damage is now, you know, you can see some of this here, and God bless them.
March organizer Peter Corliss, whose mother lives in the Rockaways, says passing the full aid package is critical because it includes money to pay for mold removal, which can be costly.
And I think what's really important is that we get people to go down and see what mold looks like in a basement. I know what my mom's own house test results look like. They're not good. And I think that we also need to make sure that people see how this is impacting families and businesses. And you're going to tear apart communities if you can't get these relief dollars in soon.
Many, like Corliss, stressed that immediate action was needed to assist thousands who remain displaced or without heat and water.
This is not good, and if we don't want to see bodies piling up come the first winter storm, we need to get them to safe shelter. You just can't play around with people's lives. We've been very blessed with a mild winter so far. We can't expect that to hold.
Actions were also held in Coney Island, Garrison Beach, Staten Island, and Long Island, as well as New Jersey's Union Beach, Seaside, and Brigantine. Organizers say they will take further action if lawmakers fail to approve full funding for Sandy recovery. With assistance from Ray Renata Bergen, this is Jessel Noor, FSRN, New York.
French forces expanded air assaults in Mali today from the north into the central region of the country. Despite the stepped-up bombardment, rebels advanced on the town of Diabolé in a march toward the capital, according to France's defense minister and media reports from the area. France has deployed more than 500 troops in the country, most of them in Bamako, the capital to the south. France began the assault last Friday, warning that some of the militant groups in the north of the country had ties to Al-Qaeda and threatened the region. The U.S. said it is considering sending drone surveillance and intelligence to support the effort. Last month, the Security Council authorized a one-year military mission led by African forces in the country, and the Council took up the issue again today. As the military situation escalates, aid groups warned of more people displaced by the fighting and disruption in access to the limited medical services in the region. For more, we're joined by Dr. Greg Elder, Deputy Director of Operations for Doctors Without Borders. He joins us from Paris. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you.
First, talk about the civilians who you've been treating who have been wounded by the air offensive. Where are they coming from?
We have projects in and around Gao, and we have additional projects in Douentza and Timbuktu. Those are hospital projects where we do emergency room activities and surgery. So well set up to accept patients wounded in combat. And many of those projects have been running since about March of last year.
So your teams in Timbuktu, which is not in the immediate area of the conflict that we're talking about, they have seen injured people.
In Timbuktu, over the last couple of days, we've received, you know, a couple of dozen patients in the hospital who have, you know, fresh wounds. People are coming from quite far, 7 or 8 hours drive away, and the streets of Timbuktu are relatively empty. We're not sure if that means that everyone has fled, or people are just afraid and they're sort of hiding in their own homes. Certainly, the analysis of the team on the ground is that people are a bit afraid to move and don't feel like they can move freely and even access the hospital.
You mentioned Gao as well. That was the site where militants had claimed control of that as a capital. There are reports that the French bombing drove some of the militants out, but your staff there is saying that there are people who are coming in for treatment?
Yeah, we have a project sort of on the outskirts of Gao, and they've made some sort of sweeps through Gao to try to see if they can support the hospital in Gao and provide extra supplies. And what they've said is that they've seen vehicles loaded with wounded patients being coming to the hospital, but not much visibility on how many patients and how many dead and wounded, nor the repartition between civilians and those active in the conflict.
Anytime there's a conflict like this or the violence steps up, the concern about refugees or those displaced is high. Your organization has a team, has personnel along the border with Mauritania, and you report some refugees there. What's the latest situation there?
Yeah, the team in Mauritania work in a camp called Fassala, and they've said that over the last few days there's been several hundred people come in principally from near Funchi and Lere, which are close to the border, and those refugees have stated that there's many more on their way, but most of them can't find vehicles to travel in, are having to travel by foot, so it may be several days before they get there. Obviously, they may not be in a great state when they arrive, and so we're sort of reinforcing the activities and trying to provide mobile clinics en route to take in charge anyone who is wounded or to provide relief materials.
The UN Security Council took up the issue today. This is Ambassador Mohammad Masood Khan of Pakistan, the president of the Security Council for January, speaking late last week.
The members of the Security Council express their grave concern over the reported military movements and attacks by terrorist and extremist groups in the north of Mali. In particular, their capture of the city of Kona near Mopti. This serious deterioration of the situation threatens even more the stability and integrity of Mali and constitutes a direct threat to international peace and security.
Ambassador Khan calls it a direct threat to security, and countries including France do not appear to be close to backing down. Greg Elder with Doctors Without Borders, what are your concerns as a military conflict continues in the coming days?
Well, I mean, as you noted, that there's certainly a strategic line being drawn, and sort of a line in the sand across the territory of central Mali to prevent the rebels continuing to march towards Bamako. As that expands to the north and to the northeast, we're talking about bombardment in areas where there's relatively few medical services available to patients either directly affected by the combat or displaced by the combat. So for us, movement is very limited, very restricted, and you know our concern obviously is that you know civilians are respected in the ongoing conflict, and that humanitarian relief and medical services are given the space to be able to operate and are respected by combatants on both sides.
Greg Elder is Deputy Director of Operations for Doctors Without Borders. He joined us to discuss the stepped-up military action in Mali and the risk to civilians in the area. Greg Elder, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Torian.
In the UK, advocacy groups are voicing concern over decreased funding for the country's seniors. The number of people 65 and older is projected to increase by more than 23% over the next decade, and critics say the government is failing to address the needs of the country's aging population. One of the services that's seen reductions is daycare centers, which support older people who are living on their own. Without them, advocates say older people are left without an important support system. FSRN's Gloria Kumkar reports.
In the tennis questions.
Near Southampton City Centre, about 15 seniors gather in a small house. It's a drop-in centre for local residents aged 60 and over. The centre offers activities, advice and news and information. Today some of those gathered smile while they chat and drink tea. Others are watching a quiz show on television. 67-year-old Euro is originally from Jamaica and has been living in England since 1955. He says being around other people is very important.
Salt or chili powder.
I live on my own, and there's no one to talk to. I got here. I have company, and everyone that comes here, we all get on very well, and it keeps my sanity. Without I wouldn't manage. Without this, I don't know how I would cope.
In the UK, seniors who have assets over $35,000 get no financial support from the government, and they need to pay for their own care and services. Seniors who have less can ask a doctor to refer him or her to the local social services, which then conducts an assessment to determine what type of care plan the person needs. Thousands have been referred to daycare centres. Ranjan Patel works with the charity Age Concern as health and well-being coordinator. She says the services have been hit by funding cuts.
Daycare center provide arts and craft activities, sing-along, celebration of any occasion, and chair-based exercise, you name it. But daycare center closing down due to funding cutback, and at the same time the charges, really really high charges applied to service users, so it become very very expensive for the service users.
Additionally, Patel says some centers that served specific ethnic and immigrant communities have had to shut down completely.
I think not only the mainstream community, especially, you know, BME community, also suffering it a great deal. For example, when Suhana Center closed down, the member used to get help from religious organization, and they support for a while. But it's not the same, because now all they do is watch television or playing cards or just sit down. So it's a real, real concern for older people and their family members.
Some centers that are still open are struggling with staffing and program cuts. According to a survey of social care service users conducted by the UK government, nearly one in four felt they didn't get enough social interaction or felt socially isolated. Lorenzo Gediz says, apart from the minimal support at the drop-in center, he receives no social interaction.
I was working, and then I finished work, retired, and so I joined the drop-in center. The things we do here is we play games like dominoes and drafts, and then we tell stories. We enjoy it quite well because had we not come here, we would be at home, and it would be very boring at home. So it's much better to come here and mix with people.
Local authorities have cut down their spending on senior social care by more than $1 billion in the last 2 years, according to Age UK. That makes things difficult for people like Aston Jones, who is nearing 70 and is living on his own.
Well, we don't seem to do much nowadays, but in time gone by, we used to go out on trips, go to different places, but... Well, there's not much money around now, so during the week when we come here, the men would go and play domino or we listen to music. The women, they do some needlework and things like that.
Advocacy groups have been warning for years that the UK faces a major crisis if it doesn't address how to fund services for the aging population. But critics say little has been accomplished. After reviewing the current social care support system, a government commission has recommended that every individual should make a lifetime contribution of about $55,000 towards the social care costs. If an individual's care costs exceed this limit, they would be eligible for full support from the government. Age UK supports the proposal and is calling on the government to establish a sustainable system of social care funding. Gloria Khamkar, FSRN, Southampton, England.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Nell Abram. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Janine Etter. Our theme music was composed and produced for FSRN by Alan Weatherhead. Our Washington, D.C. intern is James Helmsworth. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org. And follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/FSRN. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.